I hope you all enjoyed your coffee.
You need to be turned up.
It's specially brewed for you in the cup. Okay, well, it's a real pleasure to have all the contributors to the symposium. Let's start on the right. Sue Brain. Wow, an amazing person, has had an NDE. She runs, at the moment, a barge up and down the Thames.
A narrow boat, not a barge.
It's called Mystic Moon, and it's terrific. And she does it all on her own. But she's not only doing that, she's doing pop-up deaf cafes. And the pop-up deaf cafe is the latest thing. So it was really Sue's energy at the beginning of our research project into end-of-life experiences that got us over the first hump, because everybody you went to say, no, they don't occur, because I was talking to doctors, and if they do occur, they are of no importance. And Sue said, rubbish. Let's actually test this. And so she found a friend, and they had to be a friend at that time, in the Middlesex Hospital. And she very kindly arranged with this friend for us to interview a palliative care team. And that was our first thing,
yeah.
And so that was fantastic. I'd meant to bring you an email I got yesterday. But, of course, I haven't, but I know what it said. And what it said, it was from a director of about 50 nursing homes in the States, in the state of Minnesota. And I met him at a conference in New York, and I told him all about what we'd been doing and about end-of-life experiences, etc. He said, OK, well, he'd go back and he'd ask all the people in his 50 nursing homes whether, in fact, he saw this in the people who died. And his email was so enthusiastic. Yes, they all know about it. They all find it. They don't know how to cope with it. But this idea of transcendence, the end of life, is almost universal. What about that, guys? Isn't that amazing? So that's Sue. And then we have Ornella. Ornella's absolutely wonderful. Ornella was a PhD student who I helped to supervise, and she now runs her own unit at...
I'm at the University of Hertfordshire now, yes.
And Ornella is Italian and brings a wonderful creative energy to the whole field of near-death experiences, and she worked in Japan, and she talks a lot about or studied body image and the relationship of the body to mind. It was a fascinating thesis, and it's been published as a book.
Yes. Can I just say, Peter, that you were the first person that I met in London. You took me here. I was studying, drugs in Italy. So I was interviewing people who actually had near-death and out-of-the-body experience through a dissociative drug called ketamine. And I found this very fascinating. I never heard before about near-death experiences. So I found out about the work of Peter and Elizabeth, and that brought me to the country. I met Peter and I said, look, I really want to study this. And thanks to Peter and Elizabeth, I had my PhD approved and then done amazing work in the field. So your inspiration is still the same to me. I'm very grateful.
But it was a fascinating study. I'd love to ask how many of you have tried K, but I will restrain myself. because what Ornella was doing, she was asking the question, is the experiences of those people who have taken street ketamine the same as those who have near-death experiences? And the answer to that is...
Well, the experience is very much the same and has a true transformational power, as I will tell more later. So, you know, there is definitely a correlation with that, yes.
So then you come down to this question of brain versus transcendent experience. And the ketamine works on something called the NMDA receptor. So is all this NMDA receptors? Well, for various reasons, I don't think it is. But yes, Ornella was right in doing this. Now, you've heard from David and you've heard from Rupert. And the symposium today is on the near-death experience. So I think probably what Ornella has said is absolutely fundamental. Is the near-death experience just the release of NMDA? What do you think, Ornella?
Can we just mention him and...
Oh, yes. I'm terribly sorry. There are two other people who should be here. One is Pim van Lommel. We're really sad that Pim can't be here. And he can't be here because his flight was delayed at Amsterdam. It was a British Airways flight. His plane broke down. They kept him waiting all day, so he couldn't get another flight. And then in the end, they said, sorry, you'll have to spend the night in Amsterdam. So unfortunately, can't be with us. And Penny Sartori, whose book you may have seen. Penny was another PhD student that worked with me. And she's an intensive care unit nurse. And I remember going down to Swansea with Penny to talk to the ethics committee and see if we could persuade them that NDE experiences were something which we should study. And they agreed, somewhat reluctantly. But Penny, in fact, has done a wonderful study, and again, she's published her thesis as a book. So we are diminished a bit, but we're not, because Rupert's come along to help us out. Okay, tell us why
so
they can't
going,
all just be an MDA.
Going back to your question, yes. Near-death experiences, for me, they go far beyond MDMA mandate reception, you know, and they go very much beyond reductionists and the attempt to locate consciousness somewhere in the brain. But they go also far beyond the proof of a scientific proof of an afterlife. I really think the near-death experiences, they really bring us back in the here and now, and the meaning and the sense of purpose that we need to develop in this life. So for me, it's not very much about the after, it's not very much the reductioning, but it's very much about the power of being here now in this very moment. It takes us very much to reflect about the body, our physical body, not seen as an object, like the dualistic model of the body machine, but body that is alive and embedded in the environment. It's very much about the sense of interconnection between body, mind, and environment around us, and to feel that connection with nature and all the universe. That's a clear message that comes out again and again from people who had an experience, who had near-death experiences, and I was very privileged to meet and interview them. This sense of interconnection is very much studied in Japanese philosophy. As Peter mentioned, I had the opportunity to work at the University of Tokyo on a project on near-death experiences. Well, in Japan, this sense of interconnection is defined as a sense, a state of betweenness. We are always in between things. In Japanese, it's aidagara. What Sushi said, that this is the most important aspect of a human being. Think about that. The most important aspect of a human being is a sense of betweenness, of connection with others and the environment around. How beautiful it is. This has also been increasingly proven by science, if we want to look at that. We are moving in that direction, even in terms of scientific research. And there's also a clear message that comes from people who had a near-death experience and experienced death itself. So a strong message is very much back in the body and the connection with others and the environment around. While in Japan, I also had the opportunity to look at the Japanese philosophy of death and life, Shiseikan. And I would like to notice here how the term death precedes life in the translation of the term. So in Japanese philosophy, there is not a clear distinction between death and life, but they are very much part of one. So just to make an example, death is present in an infant as life is present in a sick old man. So every day we die, every day we live. So it's a completely different view on our approach of death and life. such as strict interrelation between life and death, is also rich in Japanese everyday lifestyle. I don't know how many of you had the opportunity to go to Japan, a country that I love very much. My first week in Japan, I would like to give you an example very briefly. I know that the time. My first week in Japan was the week of the cherry blossom, the sakura. Beautiful, amazing festivals where people meet and celebrate life and death. And I was looking at the Japanese staring at trees for hours, and I wonder, how can they stare at trees for hours? I mean, I do appreciate beauty and nature immensely, but I can't stare at trees for hours. Then I started studying it, and I understood that for them, it's a moment of reflection on death and life. Life is extremely beautiful, like the blossom, but it can disappear very quickly, so it's impermanent, and we need to be aware of that. But even death is always a part of life, and we go back to the circle. Another example that comes from Japanese everyday life is the shimenawa. The shimenawa is this sacred robe that is hung around trees in parks in Tokyo. So I was wondering at the beginning why in Japan they have trees with a belt. They were always beautiful trees, I'm like, oh, that's strange. And then I learned that the shimenawa represents, indicates the presence of a kami or a divinity. But for the Japanese, the kami is not inside the tree, like a soul or consciousness could be inside the body. But the tree itself is a divinity. So this is exactly what I wanted to share with you. For me, the meaning of the near-death experiences is very much coming back to the sense of the body as a subjective body in an interconnected environment.
Thanks very much. Now, I think, Sue, I want you to come into this, but first of all, I'd like to introduce David again to you for his work on NDEs. His first book was what? Hole in One, David, was it?
Survival.
Survival. And so David has been in the NDE field for a very long while. Now, with all this knowledge behind you, sum it up for us, David.
There you are. Well, my first book, Survival, came out in 1984, and I worked on it particularly over the summer of 1982 and wrote most of the book over the summer holidays. And then no computers, so I had to type it out all again, typed it out 240 pages at 3 pages a day to work that out, and eventually came out in 1984. And what I wanted to say today was really just make two points. When I conceived of survival, and it's going to reappear as a Kindle called Death as Transition, and I was asking this basic question that Rupert was also referring to, you know, is the brain responsible for producing consciousness? And I was hugely influenced in my answer to this question by three philosophers who were working at the end of the 19th century. William James, already mentioned. Henri Bergson, who said the brain is the organ of attention to life. And then a much less well-known philosopher called Ferdinand Schiller, not to be confused with Friedrich Schiller, the German dramatist. And Schiller wrote, he was a fellow of Corpus Christi, Oxford, and he wrote a book which came out in 1891 called Riddles of the Sphinx. And this is an almost unknown book. It's an absolutely brilliant book. And he said by a troglodyte, by a cave dweller. So he's referring to Plato, being in Plato's cave. And so he didn't really dare put his own name to it, but eventually it came out that it was by him. And all three of these people were interested in psychical research. Bergson and James were actually both presidents of the SPR in the UK. I don't think, and Schiller was very interested. And he was asking, you know, when you see death from the outside, does that mean that the consciousness has disappeared from the inside? And his answer and the answer of Bergson and James was no. So just looking at the appearance might look as if the consciousness has disappeared altogether, but it hasn't. And in the Ingersoll lecture on immortality from 1898, and it's still worth reading that little book, it was delivered at Harvard, he explains that there are a number of different ways of looking at the relationship between consciousness and the brain. And one of these is the orthodox one, which has already been referred to, which is that the brain produces consciousness. Therefore, when death comes, there cannot be any consciousness. And the other is that the brain acts in some sense as a medium for the transduction or transmission of consciousness. And one has to remember this is a metaphor. It's not an accurate description of anything. It's simply a metaphor. But it's something gives one a slightly different handle on it. And James said that all the things that have been mentioned this morning, out-of-body experiences and the near-death cardiac arrest, they're only compatible with a view of the brain and consciousness that consciousness, in some sense, transcends the brain. Hence my general argument that death is transition rather than extinction. So that's one point. The second point is the essential message of Hole in One, which is my second book, which is subtitled The Near-Death Experience and the Ethic of Interconnectedness. So it works very nicely with what you just said. And I observed, in not just in the Life Review and the near-death experience, which was the focus of this book, but that people could feel what it was like to be someone else. And I call this empathetic resonance. And some people feel it between twins. Another example was a husband and wife, where the husband went out sailing and the wife was having breakfast, and she suddenly felt this sort of blow to the face, although nothing had happened to her. And that coincided with the moment that the jib had come across and hit her husband in the face as he was going about on the boat just a few hundred yards away. And there are other examples of this. And then it seemed to me that an interpretation of the deep life review, not just panoramic memory when there's no feelings associated with it, but with the deep life review, when you experience what it's like to experience the whole event, not just your perspective on it. And so, for instance, today we've got this wonderful event, but there are as many versions of the event as there are people in the room. And so if you were to experience what it was like to have the experience of being here today, then you would have to experience what it's like to be everybody. And in a crude sense, this only involves a few other people, then you experience what it's like to be the other person. And that's a learning experience. And this applies both positively and negatively. So you would experience what it's like to be someone where there's pain involved, but also where you've given something to somebody and that's had an extraordinary result. And it seemed to me, and it still seems to me, that the fact that it's possible for us to share in each other's experiences in this way indicates that there's only one mind. Fundamentally, there's only one mind, and we're all expressions of that same mind. So I would slightly reformulate it in the light of the reading I've done in New Thought. But I think this is the underpinning idea that there is only one mind, and we're all expressions of this same mind. And the Life Review gives us an insight into this interconnectedness. And the injunction from it, if you like, is the golden rule, that we should treat others as if they were ourselves. So those are the two points I thought I'd make.
Thanks very much. Rupert, we're sort of straying onto your ground. Would you like to make any comments?
Well, I myself am very interested in near-death experiences, and I've nearly died twice, but I didn't have an NDE either time. But I've had something very like an NDE through psychoactive substances. One was ketamine, the other was DMT, dimethyltryptamine, which has a very intense, short-acting, but unbelievably intense experience that corresponds very much with the descriptions of out-of-body and near-death experience. So that got me very interested in it personally. I'm also interested in near-death experiences as rites of passage. Many people who have them have their life changed by them. And we assume this is something that happens spontaneously or in medical emergencies. But actually, in traditional cultures, people have, I think, deliberately brought them on. I myself think that John the Baptist, St. John the Baptist, was a drowner. And if you think about it, there are people queuing up on the bank of the River Jordan. They come into the river. He holds them under, probably just the right amount. He must have had a good bit of experience. I mean, he might have lost one or two, but that was sort of... that was pre-litigation. And and they come up, and they say, I've seen my whole life. I've been died, and I've been born again. And their lives are changed. And then, next, please. And so this is a low-tech, low-cost method of inducing near-death experiences. And many cultures have rites of passage that involve going to the brink of death. I think drowning, death by drowning, is the simplest to induce, the cheapest. And, you know, and I think that when we look at culture and rites of passage in this context, it takes on a new significance through this recent research. I myself think that when we die, it's rather like dreaming, and that we all have another body every night when we dream, our dream body. We can walk around, fly, talk to people, go to places. All of us, every night, are practicing having another body other than the physical body that's lying asleep in bed. And so my own view is that the near-death and out-of-the-body experiences are continuous with the dream body in some way or another, and that when we die, it's like going on dreaming without being able to wake up. Now, the kind of dreams you have will depend on the kind of person you are, your experiences, your memories, your faith, your expectations. It may be that jihadi suicide bombers actually do, at least for a while, experience themselves in groves of palm trees being waited on by almond-eyed dancing girls, feeding them dates. I mean, maybe that actually does happen. I think there's people who are particularly paranoid, fearful, and who have no sense of hope may get trapped in nightmares. I think that those who have a belief there's a way onwards and so on, even after death, may be in something like what the Roman Catholics call purgatory, an ongoing process of development. So my own view is that the intermediate state, the near-death experience, can lead to something like a dream state. But that's, of course, only a theory, and I can't prove it. But it's my own way of trying to make sense of the data and also of our own experience, because we all have dreams, and we all have the experience of another body, even if we've never had a near-death experience or never taken DMT or ketamine or been subjected to a drowning initiation. I think that we've all had dreams, and I think that, for me, is the best starting point for making sense of these things.
That's very interesting, and I'll talk about it in a moment, but there's a guy called Kevin Nelson who has argued that the near-death experiences are, in fact, REM intrusion, that's dreaming intrusion into real life, but I'll go into that. But first of all, I'd like to ask Sue. Sue's had a near-death experience, and I'd like to ask her if it's changed her and why you now have come into your pop-up death cafes.
I did. I was involved in a light aircraft crash, and it completely changed my life. This was about 15, 20 years ago, and it catapulted me onto the journey that I now am on, because I was living rather a hedonistic lifestyle at the time. And I can remember actually sort of sitting beside the plane, what was left of it, just thinking my life is a sham. And if I was going to live and make something of myself, I had to radically change what I was doing. So it catapulted me onto a profound 20-year healing journey, which sort of culminated in me doing an MA in the Rhetoric and Rituals of Death. It's where I met Peter and started doing the end-of-life experience research. And listening to everybody this morning and to the speakers here today, the one thing that's missing for me, which I have learnt through my own journey, is love. And I think when you face death, and I'm spending an awful lot of time talking about dying at the moment because people are coming to my pop-up death cafes on Mystic Moon, my narrowboat, and that's my journey now. That's my calling to, of service, if you like. That's what I believe I'm, this is the next step along my path. And I think love is, it's a love that I've never found in human form or in human relationships, but it's a love of the divine, I think. That's how I describe it. But I also call it this love, and we certainly experienced this when Peter and I were doing the study, how love plays such an important part in the dying process. I'm not talking about people who die violently or suddenly or suicide. That's a whole different area that actually I was talking about on one of the death cafes I've just run recently, which was a fascinating discussion about how love can also play a huge part in those kinds of deaths. But I'm talking about people who have protracted deaths, and this love, and I call this love the deep meeting. It's the deep meeting of who we are as human beings, and this connection with something else more than us. And certainly in the end of life experience research that we did, people seem to be organically called to reconcile with their unfinished business. And I call that love, because it helps them die at peace. And it heals rifts in families. Not everybody does this, of course, but we found a large percentage, didn't we, Peter? I think love is also very present when somebody, against all medical odds, stays alive until that one special person comes to visit them, and then they feel that they can die. I think that's a love beyond human. I mean, it's human love, but it's something else as well. Theta, your friend. Thetis, your friend, was talking about having a vision of fantastic beauty. Well, that's transcendent love. I think that's this deep connection, this deep meeting of who we truly are in that moment. Maybe, you know, the human love and the divine love meet. And I find that absolutely fascinating. And Maggie Latourelle, she's written a wonderful book about her mum's death. She's here. Oh, she's just sitting over there. About her mum being taught how to die by a loving force. And I think this happens more than we realise. This happened to my father as well. He couldn't speak, but I know. He was a teacher. And just by the way he was listening and holding, he was sort of a lot of time spending like this for 8 days it took to die from the stroke he was in. And I know he was being taught something. I just know he was. And I think that's, again, some fantastic extra a love beyond what we know, as I said, in our own human relationships, which for me always seems just like, That yearning's still there somehow for me. And I think with near-death experiences, people profoundly change their lives once they have been met. They go through the tunnel. That's normally isn't it? That's the kind of thing. And meet, maybe it's a higher force than they are. Maybe it's their higher self. Maybe it is an angel. Maybe it is God. Who knows? But because of that existential love, they come back profoundly changed and do something really meaningful in their lives. And I'm discovering that this deep meeting takes place in the pop-up death cafes. And it might be just because the narrowboat, Mystic Moon, is a very, very intimate space. But complete strangers come onto her, and maybe it's the way she rocks. And we're sitting on water, and it's just so cozy. She's such a beautiful boat. That this deep, deep connection happens very quickly with us. And people just open their hearts. And the quality of conversation and the truth and the love that everybody feels as they share incredibly intimate stories about death, and their own personal anguish and pain of being alive, because obviously life and death are so interchangeable, really. that it touches me so deeply, and it's certainly helping me to love more openly and more honestly. And I am really curious about where this year for me is going because of it, and this deep meeting of love and truth.
Well, what I think would be very nice now is if we open the forum up to the floor. If you have an experience you want to say, that would be great, but keep it short.
Hello, my name is Serge. I want to ask, ordinarily, if one has a transcendent experience, you tend to interpret it according to the stage that you're at, i.e., if you're an Islamist and you have a transcendent experience, you'll interpret it in terms of, well, you know, God means me to kill other people for my God, and it's right to kill. When you have an NDE, is it interpreted as according to the level or stage that one is at, or is one taken to a new stage? In other words, if an Islamist were to have an NDE, would it transform him from the stage, from the low level of, you know, fundamentalist mindset, and take him to another level that would be, as it were, enduring, so that it's not just a step level, but it's a stage development, and you remain at that stage?
That is such a fascinating question, because it's absolutely fundamental. It's fundamental to the whole question of NDEs and what they do. I think probably most people here would like to say something about that. I know particularly Sue. But having listened to a lot of people tell their NDE stories, never had one myself, it's very, very clear that what Rupert says is absolutely right. Maybe there are some people who get virgins. 72, is it, Rupert? That's because that's the position that they're at. And then a number of people within the experience either ask questions or come to understand. And some people really understand the universe very widely, and with their understanding goes a metamorphosis of they themselves as they see and understand themselves in the experience. And it's always the progressive loss of bodily form, and it's the change into an energy form of some sort. And then it moves in the deepest ones that I've come across to a fusion of that energy form with the general energy form of the background, and they then are absorbed into the universal nature and into universal consciousness, because all this is taking place within consciousness. So I think it contains both elements, the first one of which is that the state at which you are at when you go into the experience is very important, but also the experience can, for some people, be profoundly transformative. And the ones who've had these very deep experiences and nearly fused with the universal are markedly changed by it. They come back quite different. They show certain characteristics, one of which is that they always break down into tears if you encourage them to go forwards into the experience. And many of them stop at that point because it is still so moving for them. A lot of them come back with new gifts, psychic gifts. I've told this story before, but it's an interesting one. I had one such guy, and he used to invite us to the Ritz, to have dinner there, and he was an air traffic controller, and I don't know how he actually had enough money to stay at the Ritz. But knowing that he'd had a near-death experience, I thought, oh, yes, I know what's going on. He knows what's going to happen. So I said to him, tell me about the stock exchange, will you? And he said, what do you want to know? And I said, I want to know what shares are going to go up in the next few weeks, please. And he said, okay, because he understood absolutely what I was saying, and this, in fact, was a test for him in some way. And he said, buy BT. And so did I immediately rush out and put money on BT? No, I didn't, because I thought, interesting. And I lost the opportunity of making a huge sum of money. So they, I'm looking at my wife. So they do get these gifts. Sue, you know a lot about this.
I don't think I didn't come back with gifts. I think everything got sharpened. I think that's what it was for me. But it wasn't, it was an epiphany. In the fact that I realised that I couldn't go on living the way I was living. But then it was a journey, so that's what it did for me. It made me go on this massive journey, which has kind of led to me sitting here right now and sort of looking back. I think also I felt like I entered a flow, a universal flow, and I'm doing a lot of experimentation at the moment with moorings. And it's kind of, Holy Mary, Mother of Grace, please give me a mooring space so I can run my pop-up death cafe. Because it's so hard to get a mooring in London, and it's happened every time. It's just quite extraordinary. So thank you, thank you, thank you. So I'm very conscious about the flow, and I think the more we open up to ourselves and whatever this is that guides us and nurtures us and leads us on our way, there's a flow, there's a sort of knowing that you're not actually, although we are alone, we're not alone, there is something far greater, and that's what it did for me. It hasn't necessarily made my life any easier, because suffering is very much part of my own life experience. But I think, Serge, what you were also saying was, does everybody in every religion have the same experience? Is that true? Is that what you were saying?
I was saying that there's a difference between a stage and a state, and if you're at a low state,
oh right,
do you get taken to a new stage through an NDE? Because
right, well, you have to come back here. That's the trouble. I wish we didn't. I wish I could have stayed in another place. But you have to. If you're going to have an NDE, you're going to live.
Well, I'm not talking about moving to a, you know, sort of leaving the earth, but if you are in a non-dual place and you have an NDE, do you experience it very differently than the Islamist who's at a low state or at a low stage who has the NDE? Is it?
I have no idea. I don't know.
It's just the difference between states and stages, that's all.
I don't know. Somebody else needs to answer that. I can't answer that.
Okay, well, let's move on to the next question, because there are a lot of questions there. Madeline and anybody, whatever.
Oh, right. Well, I've been given the microphone because I was going to... I look at spiritual experiences, and I wanted to engage with Sue and just say that I've been leading quiet days, creating a safe space for people to speak. And the love you're talking about, I have found, goes through death. I often have widows who come to join my quiet days. And again, because it's a safe space, they open up and tell me about experiences they've had from the dead partner, and which really seems to emphasize this transcendent love continuing through death, and still supporting their spouse here on earth, but going on further as well themselves. So sorry, I was told to jump in, and I don't know who wants this next.
Well, that's certainly a lot of people on the on the pop-up death cafes who talk about that. We had somebody talking about that yesterday, exactly that, that the, they felt a presence of their dead partner putting their arms around them to comfort them. So, you know, there's definitely a lot of evidence suggesting that that life, not that we know it here necessarily, but, you know, you're talking about the veil is very thin, and I support that belief.
Yes, I think that's true. Okay.
Is this working? I've been to quite a few funerals recently, and I had a question that I couldn't answer without seeming a bit of a wishful thinking. I'll be frank, I'm very interested in these things, but I'm not sure how much I accept in terms of survival. And the question was basically, well, it was a statement, this fellow who said, a mourner who said, you know, it's all fairy tales, isn't it? They say you're going to another place, but you're not. You know, it's just what we're brought up as Christians to believe. And I honestly couldn't start to address all of these issues because I felt I would sound like a fool. And I would like to ask how the panelists would approach this issue in a highly secular and sceptical society, in a way that's sensitive to these issues.
Rupert, here's a nice one for you. Our highly secular, sceptical society, how do you handle it?
Well, most people who take the highly secular, sceptical point of view are true believers in materialism. I mean, when they say, show me proof of the existence of God, or show me proof of survival of death, they're assuming that they're standing in a solid position of knowledge and truth, and to prove anything different, you've got to prove it. They're actually within, I think, a deeply depressing worldview that they are not even aware that they've got a worldview. They think they know the truth, and everyone else has beliefs. One of the points of my book, The Science Delusion, is to point out that this itself is a worldview which is not based on scientific evidence, which is shapes up very poorly when examined in the light of science. So I'm not a materialist because I don't think it's been proved. I don't think there's much evidence for it. So I think it's probably starting from the wrong place to say, okay, we agree everything's secular, materialistic, and so on. Anything else has got to be proved, but this doesn't have to be proved. I think that really ought to be proved, and it isn't proved, and it's a kind of delusory worldview that our whole civilization's in the grip of. So I wouldn't really want to start by agreeing that that is the starting point. It isn't the starting point. It's a worldview that I reject on scientific grounds. So I think when we start from experience, then we're in much stronger grounds. I mean, the idea that dreams, for example, are in the brain follows from the same logic that all our experiences in the brain. It's a materialist assumption. How do we know that we're not actually traveling in our dreams as we seem to be into some kind of virtual reality realm? It may not be inside our brains at all. Our experience doesn't tell us, only this theory does. So I'm against accepting secular assumptions that are just assumptions. So I challenge the assumptions.
Okay, thank you, that's a great answer. Right, who's got the mic?
Oh, hello.
Yeah. Don't forget your name, will you?
Geeti Amirani. I have a question for Dr. Sheldrake, and to link the scientific, the medical, and the near-death experience. When we die, if science, because I've been reading a lot about the merging of spirituality and science, and if we believe that atoms and energy don't dissipate but continue, the continuance of consciousness in what the religious terminology calls spirit or soul, is that not the same as the atoms and energies surviving and continuing in some capacity? And if consciousness, this greater intelligence or consciousness that, if we want to call it for a shorthand, God, can you tell us more about that and how it's all linked? Because coming back to the John the Baptist as well, I wonder if when religious people talk about survival of the spirit and soul, are they not in fact talking about the scientific continuation of the energy that is consciousness, maybe? Because I'm reminded of what David Bohm called the scientist, the observer being the observed. And to link that back to the more universal, if we are conscious, if animals are conscious, if plants are conscious, are the planets conscious? And Dr. Sheldrake, over to you. And may I say, I hope Oxford wakes up one day and replaces Richard Dawkins, the ignoramus, with your good self for the public understanding of science.
Well, calling it energy is one way of approaching it. The point about energy as understood in science is that it has no form in itself. It's simply a flow. Energy, as understood scientifically, can take any form. The energy can be in light and it can turn into heat, and that can turn into mechanical energy, or it can turn into chemical energy, and we eat it and it, bread or something, and it turns into mental energy. Energy is a flow, and it doesn't have form by itself. So you could say that all things that exist have energy and form. And in science, everything that exists has fields which give shape or form, and energy which give actuality or activity. And in Christian theology, the two fundamental principles that underlie these are the source of all things, the Father. The Logos is the principle of form or order, as I think reflected in nature through fields. And the Spirit is the principle of flow or change. And tomorrow is, of course, the festival of the Spirit, Pentecost or Whitsun. So we're on the eve of this great festival of the Spirit. And I think that this, the flow of energy is part of it, but I don't think energy by itself is enough. You have to have form as well, or pattern. Otherwise, there's no definition. The point about this energy and form, the principal metaphor in Christian theology is speech. The word, the spoken word. And to have a word, it has to have form, pattern, connection, and so forth. But to be spoken, it has to be carried on the breath. While I'm speaking now, I'm breathing out. If I don't breathe out, if I just have words, they're silent in my mind. If I just have breath, it has no formal structure. The two together give this flow of energy which has formal structure, and that's the basic model for creation and for the divine nature. One of the models, I mean, it's one way of interpreting the Holy Trinity. So I would say that in the way in which we survive, there has to be energy in the sense of a continued activity, otherwise we just go static. And maybe we do when we go beyond a limited development and limited form and limited conception. Maybe we reach a timeless realm. I think we probably do. But it has to be combined with form. And the principle of the soul is really a principle of form. The word spirit really is to do with energy or movement. And so these two words that people use interchangeably actually have rather different meanings, and we need both.
Thank you. Okay, who else has got? Yes.
Hi, my name is Kelly Opie, Kelly for short. Happy birthday
thank
to
you.
Both you and your partner. And thank you for putting on this event where we can convene in the space of love. So turn off your mind, relax and flow downstream. It isn't dying. I got that message to give to you in regards to your boat and... psychopomps, that's an idea. The study of death has been around since the dawn of mankind and possibly the dawn of consciousness of mankind, studied in the ancient Egyptian books of the dead and in Tibetan books of the dead. And I see you all as a panel of these of priests that are bringing forth into this generation the concept of passing. And yet bringing back that knowledge, you had that feedback loop where people that had near-death experiences had gone into these realms or were transcending into these realms, and yet bringing back these messages of light and love. And then I'm going to pass forth to Rupert and his resonance, his morphic resonance concepts, which actually ties into the experiences, the near-death experiences, and the fact that I believe that the whole panel and this whole convention is based on the principle that if we can see and can perceive and can understand these concepts of light that are waiting for us, that we are part of, and that we can bring it back, we can bring these back into these realms, that life, which is in tandem with death, and we can possibly not heal, but kind of, yes, possibly heal the planet and resonate this concept of peace and light, which we're all headed for, whether we're Islamist fundamentalists, whether we blow ourselves up and then we reach an understanding what we've done, and you know, maybe we can come back and kind of bring transcend, not upwards, but also it's not really descend, but kind of dissipate the love back into this world. Is this how you see yourselves? Because this is how I see you, as priests of the transcendental. So this is the message that I'm getting through. And is this what you're doing? Is this why we're studying, you know, near death experiences? I mean, thank you.
Thanks very much. Thank you.
I've had near-death experiences, but I also read about it. And there's a lady in America who actually saw an angel and asked what you saw when you had a near-death experience. And the angel said, you see what you expect to see. So if you're a Christian, you'll see angels. If you expect to see your dead family, you'll see a dead family. Now, when I died, I didn't expect to see anything. I'd already cleared my mind of any... I like to be scientific. But I did know the week before I was going to die. I had a premonition. And I was able to realise I had responsibilities. I have a handicapped daughter. And my life was hard and I wanted to die. So I'd known I'd been asking to die. So I was suddenly told it's going to happen soon. Intuitionally, madness this is. But my husband took me seriously and lit a fire. We were living self-sufficiently. And made me a cup of tea. And I realised I shouldn't go. I had responsibilities. I imagined what would happen to all the people I loved if I was gone. Well, a week later, I'm rushed into hospital. And they operate on me. Now, I have to say, I'd had an out-of-body experience when I was four, when I was very, very ill. So I don't think I sit in my body very well. And so when I'm on the operating table, I have this experience where I feel like I've come out of a cinema, and it was a nasty film, and I've forgotten all about it, and it's really lovely. And I don't see anything, I'm just floating. And there's little lights floating at the side of me, and they go off in the distance. But I'm stopped. And a voice says, and it wasn't mine, it was like having earphone, you know, ear things in and you're listening to an opera or something. And it wasn't my voice, and it said, you can't stay here, you must go back. And I complained. I said, the light is too bright, it hurts my eyes, and I meant here. And I turn it down, the volume's too loud. And I was zoomed back. But just before I opened my eyes, the voice said, it's only for a second. Now, that was 1976. So I think our timescales are very different here. Yes. So, yes. And as I said, so I think, you know, I think it's probably true you see what you expect to see. Because obviously I didn't die. It was a near-death experience. I would have died if I'd gone out with the little lights in the distance. But then I helped my mother to die. She was 82, and she was in a home, and they didn't want her to die. She was valuable, obviously. But she was all skin and bones, and she'd been wanting to die for ages, and I'm not frightened of it. So I gave her permission to go on an eating strike. She didn't have to eat. And she'd had a stroke and couldn't talk, but I couldn't get my finger in her mouth. And I said, they won't get a spoon in there. And two nights later, she danced with me all night. And my sister rang me up in the morning, said she died in the night. Yeah. So that's very beautiful as well.
So, okay.
You know, but I do, by the way, there's one other thing I do want to say. And that is that the death is not outside of life. It's not just spirit. Sheldrick is right on this one. The thing is, we're part of the world. We're like neurons in the earth. The planet is a great big cosmic brain. And we become part of that brain again. So we don't become non-physical. We're just physical in a much, much bigger area, I think.
Okay. Well, thanks very much for that. There's just one point I'd like to take from your question. That is the whole point about responsibility. And responsibility, as far as the NDE is concerned, is definitely there. And people come back for many different reasons. One of the first people I spoke to, she was in this wonderful area, and she suddenly remembered that she had to do the ironing for her husband. And so she left the whole thing and came back for a pile of ironing. But in fact, I think it really goes much deeper than that. I think she I think this is just the symbolism which arose, and she's talking about her responsibilities, the family, and so on. So thanks very much for that. And I think probably that has to be the last question. And so let me thank you all so much for your presentations, for questions from the audience. So thank you very much.